Pro teams have millions to spend, and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry, with overpriced, underperforming products, and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
Welcome to the RotoWire Mixed Martial Arts Park podcast and now video stream. I'm happy to be here with John Litterine. If you're out there on Twitter, give him a follow at JONLITTERINE. You can give me a follow at Roto Jake. Today we're going to be talking about two biggest fights at UFC 269. We're back for the first time since last month. We got a lot going on since then, but we're going to talk some Poirier Oliveira today. But first off, UFC took a little break for Thanksgiving, and Aldo came back, and he looked good. He was your pick in the article, so props to that. What are your thoughts on how that looked and what he can really do moving forward? I know you had the Ranger game that night, too, but I'm sure you caught Aldo on paper.
Yeah, I did. He did look good. I thought it was a pretty good stylistic matchup for Aldo in that fight. Rob Font's a striker. Say what you want about Aldo. He's getting older, obviously, but if you stand there and engage him in a kickboxing match, he still is as dangerous as any guy in the division. So that one pretty much went like I thought it would. There are a lot of things they could do in that division. Maybe Aldo and TJ Dillashaw, I heard they might be talking about. That would make some sense. I don't know who I would take in that fight. I imagine TJ would probably be a slight betting favorite. But I'm pretty sure that would be competitive. I'd have to think about that one a little bit, which is good. No, he definitely looked good. You know, for not all that long ago, it looked like, you know, Jose Aldo was done after a rough run at featherweight, dropped down to bantamweight, and now he seems to have some new life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can run Aldo up to Piotr Jan again, especially after what Jan did to him in the first matchup here. I was just checking on TJ Dillashaw. I think he's had a knee injury in the win over Sandhagen, so it's quite possible that you know, maybe they do a title eliminator with Sandhagen. Maybe Dillashaw's not ready quite yet. But either way, Aldo, big name, going to keep selling fights. He's got to be sneakily climbing up the GOAT ladder here. You know, a lot of people, you know, say GSP or maybe Bones without the suspensions. But Aldo's longevity is definitely, in multiple weight classes, is definitely incredible.
Yeah, the weight class thing's big. You know, I didn't really understand why at his age he wanted to drop down, especially when he really had no problem making featherweight and making 145 pounds for his entire career. But, you know, credit to him. Maybe he saw a quicker path to make an impact at bantamweight, and he's done a nice job even dropping down. No issues making weight at the lower weight class. He's been impressive.
Mm-hmm. All right, right on. So, that's the most recent little recap, but let's jump into some fights here at UFC 269. We've got a great card here. A couple of title fights to check out. First and foremost, of course, we have to take a look at a little unification bout, Poirier was the interim at one point. He's just coming off a couple of Conor McGregor wins here. But Charles Oliveira is the champion. He's going to be taking on Dustin Poirier, of course. Poirier is the betting favorite despite being the challenger in this fight. He's minus 160. Comeback on Oliveira plus 140. DraftKings salaries reflect that. 8,600 for Poirier, 7,600 for Oliveira. Now, the odds to finish, also surprisingly, they were up there at minus 400. Maybe they changed a little bit since we posted the article here. We were looking at some kind of initial ones. I'm going to take a peek at that now. yeah, they're all in the minus 350 to minus 400 range. I think FanDuel might even have it around minus 550 right now. So if you're looking for a decision, I guess that would be the place to bet here. But, I mean, your initial thoughts on this one, John, and ultimately your pick for the winner.
This is a good fight. You know, that's no secret. Charles Oliveira's won 9 fights in a row. Won the UFC lightweight title from Michael Chandler recently. Chandler, the most impressive part about Oliveira's win over Chandler was the fact that Oliveira appeared to be done in the early stages of the fight. Mm-hmm. Chandler had him essentially pinned up against the fence and flattened out. And like at the time, I would have bet, you know, it was like 99%. 99.9% certain it looked like the fight was over.
Yeah, Chandler was about to become the champ. I think even at least one of the judges afterwards, of course, it finished in the second round, but one of the judges had a 10-8 round for Chandler. So that's pretty, that's a reflection of how dominant he was in that round.
It was that close to being stopped. Michael Chandler essentially just kind of gassed himself out going for the finish. Never got it. Charles Oliveira somehow powered through and then ended up finishing the fight in the second round, like you mentioned. Charles Oliveira's won 9 in a row, like I said a few seconds ago. In that streak, wins over Michael Chandler, Tony Ferguson, Kevin Lee, Jim Miller. I mean, you know, Liam Miller victories don't look like a ton now, but he beat them both when they were both considered top guys. Mm-hmm. He hasn't lost a fight since December 2017. That was against Paul Felder. Oliveira fights a lot. He fights frequently and he fights well. There's nothing about this rise to the top of the division that is feels fluky to me. He's legitimately that good. And I think the clear improvement in Charles over the years has been in the stand-up. He's arguably one of the very best Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioners of all time in the history of MMA. That much was never in question. The real impressive part is how much he has improved his striking. It's definitely become... it's at least average. It might be a tick above that. And, you know, the example we always use is it's kind of what happened to Henry Cejudo in the sense that Henry Cejudo had a real chance to be UFC champion if he could just get his striking to solid average because of how good of a wrestler he was. It's the same situation for Oliveira. He's so good on the mat that if he could just get his striking to average, he had a chance to be champion. And that's pretty much exactly what's happened. That being said, this is a really big ask. For Charles Oliveira in his first title defense. And as good as he's been, there's a real case to be made that Dustin Poirier has been even better of late. 7-1 in his last 8 fights. The lone loss in that streak came against Khabib Nurmagomedov, which, as I mentioned in my preview, you know, that kind of just gets tossed to the side. Nobody was able to beat Khabib, so, you know, that's no big deal. Poirier has wins over Conor McGregor twice. Dan Hooker, Max Holloway, Eddie Alvarez, Anthony Pettis, Justin Gaethje. Like, you can go down, and he has defeated everybody. I ended up taking Poirier in this fight. I went back and forth. I do like Oliveira at his DraftKings price tag. I'm not sure there's $1,000 difference between the two. And Oliveira is just so crafty that, you know, and he's in such a nice run right now that I really don't like betting against him. But I think there's a physicality edge for Dustin, which is a little bit weird to say because Oliveira is the slightly bigger man. I think he's an inch taller and has an inch reach edge or somewhere in that area. I'm curious if Dustin is going to sell out to stop takedowns because for a guy who's been around as long as Poirier has, his takedown defense is only 61%, which isn't all that great. You know, we always say you want to be, God, north of 70 is probably like solid average. Now, you got to keep in mind, you know, there were 7 takedowns in there from Khabib.
Yeah,
there were 4. Yeah, that's definitely part of it. You know,
I wanted to say that. Yeah, if we're going to throw out the Khabib fight, you know, we got to throw out those 7 takedowns. He's probably at or above that 70% we want if we throw out those 7 takedowns. The ones against Hooker were a little bit mysterious, though. I mean, Hooker got him down 4 times in a 5-round fight. So, you know, I guess he can be taken down. But I don't know if we can apply that here necessarily.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't call his takedown defense a big weakness, despite the fact the percentage is only, you know, below average. It's just Charles Oliveira has such a big advantage over every man in the division as far as submission game that there's a big, big, big edge for Dustin as long as he can keep this fight standing.
Yeah,
he certainly has more power.
Yeah, it's if Dustin gets a knockdown, he's smart enough at this point to not follow him to the ground. You know, yeah. Even if he rattles him or thinks he's going to go for the finish, he'll make him get back up and do it again, because I think that is where the advantage, of course, lies for Dustin. There's a big edge in terms of striking volume, you know, 5.62 for Dustin, 3.26 to Oliveira. Obviously, the defense, Oliveira gets hit less because he's been spending, you know, more time, you know, on the ground, on the mat, and in control. Now, when it came time to my pick, I was pretty much along the same line of thinking too. The strength of record for Dustin Poirier is it's much better, you know, in my eyes. Yeah, the Chandler win was awesome. You know, Chandler came in to the UFC. He's been a Bellator champ for a while. You know, Oliveira had a cool come from behind win there. I think the jury still might be out on Chandler a little bit, because, you know, he lost his next fight. So is Chandler really in that top tier? You know, the Ferguson win that Oliveira had doesn't look so great now. You know, after you can see that Ferguson's downfall has kind of started a little bit. And then of course you got Kevin Lee in there, who has, you know, since been cut from the UFC for different reasons, of course. But, you know, you can pick apart the record a little bit there. The strength of record definitely lies with Poirier. And I think if he can keep this fight on the feet, which, you know, he's got solid takedown defense. I mean, anyone that's been around for as many fights and faced the people that he has faced, you know, to be around that 70 mark, you know, and again, which he would be if he didn't get taken down seven times by Khabib, to be around that mark is incredibly impressive. I think he'll have enough to stay off his feet. Will he maybe get into one or two scary grappling situations? Sure, that could definitely happen, and it'll be very, very nerve-wracking when that does happen, you know. But overall, I think Poirier is the pick. I think both of these guys are very, very viable DraftKings plays. They should both be 25-30% rostered or greater on DraftKings. The pick outright is Poirier, but I definitely would advise some Oliveira exposure. He can snatch the submission and end it in a second, and that's really the biggest reason why. You don't want to be left without Oliveira exposure in the case that happens. You know, out of 10 lineups for me, maybe it's... Oh, that's really tough. Maybe six Poirier, two or three Oliveira with one stack. Generally, I don't think this is a great fight to stack, because it's not like these are two stand-up fighters that are getting a ton of volume, especially with Oliveira, 3.26 significant strikes landed per minute. Over 25 minutes, he's got a shot here, but generally that's not the high volume you'd look for in a stack necessarily. So I don't think I'd put them together in the same lineup, but there is some value I like. We'll get to that at the end of the card. But Oliveira is not a bad DraftKings play, and he definitely shouldn't be ignored, because while I'm picking Dustin, you're picking Dustin, I think most of the staff picks that are in are going to pick Dustin. I mean, when you have straight up all things equal, it probably has to be a Dustin pick. But Oliveira, I will call him a slightly live dog. He's got a shot. I'm not counting him out.
No, he definitely has a shot. Now, you know, I'm curious. He might have to kind of survive an early onslaught like he did in the Chandler fight. There might be that blitz off the top where he has to power through it. And I agree, I'm not crazy about a stack here, for the simple reason that both of these guys' strengths, neither of them really play into each other. You know, Dustin should have a massive edge on the feet, but if he's pounding Oliveira on the feet, Oliveira is not the kind of guy like Conor McGregor who's going to get into a firefight and just try and go back and forth with you. Mm-hmm. He's going to look to try and get it to the ground. So, and if the fight's on the ground, obviously it's unlikely either man's going to rack up a ton of points.
And Oliveira, he'll do whatever it takes to get him to get to the ground. He'll pull guard if he has to. He's definitely not afraid of fighting off his back. But Dustin's fight IQ, again, he's been around for a while. I'm not going to pull the "there are levels" of this quote yet, because they're both very experienced, have a ton of UFC wins. But I trust Dustin's fight IQ to not follow him to the ground in those situations. And if you straight up told me who's got more power, Chandler or Poirier, I would probably put it towards Poirier. So I think maybe, just maybe, Oliveira doesn't quite recover if he takes the same type of shot that he did from Chandler's, and is how I view that one. So definitely higher on the Poirier exposure, but because of the way the prices are set up, little bit Oliveira for me sprinkled in there for sure.
Yeah, it's a good fight. You know, it's certainly not one where I expect it to be competitive. I don't think either guy is going to run away with it, but mm-hmm. I would give a slight edge to Poirier.
Yep, I'm 100% with you there. All right, so that's the main event. We'll get to the co-main event in the second. Quick apologies for those watching on video, but I got to pause from a word for our sponsors at Blue Wire here.
Pro teams have millions to spend, and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry, with overpriced, underperforming products and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
And then we are back. All right, so co-main event. This one is a much different breakdown than the tight, interesting, intriguing main event fight that we first discussed here. We've got Amanda Nunes going up against Juliana Pena. Nunes, 9,500 on DraftKings. Pena, 6,500. The most expensive and cheapest fighters on DraftKings, respectively. I've seen odds all over the place from minus 850 to minus 1,000 for Nunes. You always like to say that means maybe the fight shouldn't be made if they're going to be that lopsided. But anyway, comeback on Pena right around plus 600. You know, we'll see where this goes. Odds to finish are minus 450. I believe Nunes has the second best finish or knockout finish prop, or the best. She's right up there with Bruno Silva, so that kind of fluctuates back and forth. Yeah, she's got the second best knockout prop here. I mean, Amanda Nunes is the most dominant women's fighter, possibly the most dominant fighter in the sport now that Khabib is out. Generally, you don't want to fade any fighter entirely if you're mass entering, but I mean, maybe throw one or two lineups in to account for the fluke situation. Nunes takes a bad step back, breaks her, you know, that kind of crazy fluke situation. Of course, hopefully I'm not speaking that new existent, but generally these fighters fight 10 times. Nunes wins 10 of them. They fight 100 times. Nunes probably wins 98 or 99 of them. I mean, I just Pena, I respect her. She's, you know, a great ranked fighter in the division, can certainly get some wins against other middle tier fighters in this division, but it's a huge ask for me.
Yeah, it's probably an impossible ask. And the crazy thing is Amanda Nunes's 9,500 DraftKings salary is actually more than it usually is because there's 15 fights on this card. The average UFC card, a full UFC card is usually 13. Mm-hmm. That's the general number. This fight card, I believe, has 15, which means she's probably a couple hundred bucks more than she would usually be. Usually you're at, you know, like 93 and 67 or whatever, but here she's all the way up at 95. Look, Amanda Nunes hasn't lost a fight since September 2014, so we're on 7+ years now. In that stretch, you know, I've said this before, Valentina Shevchenko twice, Ronda Rousey, Chris Cyborg, Holly Holm, on and on and on. You know, she's 33 years old. She looks better than ever. She hits harder than any woman in the sport. Her technique is fantastic. There's nothing to pick apart about her. She's massively strong. It's just she excels in every single area. Now back to the part where we talk about her opponent. Look, Juliana Pena is 2-2 in her last four fights. You know, any reasonable expectation is a fighter 2-2 in their last four fights shouldn't be fighting for a title. That's just how it goes. You know, look, Juliana Pena had a bunch of promise early in her career. She kind of got stunted a bit by, you know, she had a kid, birth of her child, which, you know, put her on the sideline for a while. Then she had a really, really bad knee injury. She ripped up her entire knee. She tore like every ligament in her knee. And look, it set her back. You know, she's fought three times since July 2019. So in 2.5 years, she's fought three times. She'll be 32 years old later this month. So she's not, you know, she's certainly not in the athletic prime of her career. I think through, you know, circumstances that, you know, aren't her doing, I think she might have just like missed the boat a little. Like if, you know, obviously having a child was her decision, but I really think the knee injury set her back. And she might have got there at one point, but I think the odds are against her getting there now. And if you just look at this fight in particular, stylistically, it appears to be a disaster for Pena. You know, she does virtually all of her damage on the mat, but Amanda Nunes is much bigger, much stronger, and defends a takedown at 84%. So we were talking about Dustin Poirier. What was he at, like 61, I think it was? Amanda Nunes is at 84%. If Juliana Pena is not able to get Amanda Nunes to the ground, Amanda Nunes is going to obliterate her on the feet. She's going to cream her. It's not going to be remotely close. Look, the bottom line is, and this is pretty much what I say about every Amanda Nunes fight and Valentina Shevchenko fight at this point. Essentially, we're kind of just spinning our wheels until they fight again for a third time. The first two fights between the two were extremely competitive, and that's what we're leading up to. You know, Amanda Nunes has not sold particularly well when she's headline pay-per-views. You know, buys have not been that great. So the UFC has kind of settled into putting her in like a co-main event spot, which is fine. You know, look, she earns a paycheck. She gets to keep her title. You know, it's kind of a win-win for everybody. You know, we should probably mention that this fight was supposed to take place in August. Nunes tested positive for COVID, so it had to be pushed back a handful of months. You know, I don't think either of us think that's going to matter. Look, you kind of have to. There's a real chance that even at 9,500, if you're in a mass tournament type deal with a bunch of, you know, thousands of people, there's a chance you're going to get totally locked out if you don't have her in your lineup. Mm-hmm. So I know it's killing you to spend 9,500, you know, gigantic chunk of your salary on just one fighter. But if you don't have her, there's probably at least a 50-50 chance you're not going to have a chance to get one of those top prizes. So,
yep.
You know, to solve that, you make multiple lineups, you know, have a minimal exposure, like in some cases, like you said, just in case, you know, she does take a wrong step and break her leg or foot or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for the most part, we talk all the time about how it's painful, you know, kind of just close your eyes and click it to spend so much salary. But yeah, Believe it or not, more often than not, when you have a fighter that's this dominant against such an inferior opponent, it usually pays off.
Yeah, I just got a couple small things to say on this before we'll move on to some of the more complex breakdowns, I guess. But, you know, since taking the belt from Misha Tate, Amanda Nunes has been under 98 DraftKings points just once. That's when she put up 80 against Shevchenko. And she can pay off that salary in a variety of ways. I mean, you know, against Anderson or Holm, there were knockouts, you know, Cyborg, you know, Pennington. Pennington was a late knockout, but, you know, you can get a point early for big knockouts here. She's got a few of those on her resume. But also you look at Felicia Spencer and Jermaine Durandamay, five-round fights where Nunes, you know, early on at the start of her title reign, if you were trying to figure out a way that she might lose, you know, you might go turn to her sinus and her breathing situation. That has been clearly corrected. She put up 158.9 DraftKings points against Jermaine Durandamay. And Durandamay, just a couple fights ago in her most recent fight, she choked out Juliana Pena. And Durandamay doesn't choke anybody out. That is not at all part of her game.
No, she's an elite-level kickboxer.
That is it. So then Pena goes and gets choked out by Durandamay. Then Pena comes back. She gets a third-round submission against Sarah McMahon, and suddenly she's in the title fight. So, again, it's a lack of options that's leading us here. I personally like Pena. I mean, I won money on her when I bet on her against Catanzaro in Vegas at UFC 200. I remember her fondly, you know, but I just can't pick her to win, and there's no chance here. You know, Nunes is maybe close to 100% exposure, but if you're really mass entering, maybe you cap it at 80 or so, just in case, you know, she underperforms and doesn't get the early finish or doesn't put the same volume on that we thought. If it turns into a clinch battle, maybe she doesn't get the same volume, and you know, you do one of your weird strategies in tournaments to not eat the chalk necessarily, but cash games and yeah, most tournaments, I think you know. Most of your lineups, you have to figure out how many Nunes lineups am I going to have and how am I going to get the value around her. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And I mean, there are two other things I just want to mention quick. You know, I didn't mention in my preview article, but like, Juliana Pena like doesn't really have like a signature win in her career. Like the Zingano win is probably her best one. Like she defeated Jessica I back when I was, you know, a bit highly more thought of than she is now, but like, Nico Montano, you know, Miliana Dudieva, Jessica Rico. Like, it's not like
Montano's out of the UFC, and the win that got her a title shot was against a 41-year-old Sarah.
Yeah. And I mean, and the other thing is, look, Nunes fights a lot. Here's what Julianne Pena has done recently: twice in 2015, once in 2016, once in 2017, not at all in 2018, once in 2019, once in 2020, and she's going to get to twice in 2021, and that's only because she fought in January and December, yeah. Or else she wouldn't have got to twice in 2021 either. Mm-hmm. It just, look, this is, I mean, you know, we're here to, you know, generate discussion and have podcasts, you know, some back and forth, but, you know, this isn't really the fight to do it. This is, you know, as straightforward as it gets.
It's definitely not. Let's take a look at a pick'em, though. You know, the fight setting the stage for the two title fights here is a welterweight matchup between Jeff Neal and Santiago Ponzinibbio. Dead heat in the sports books here as far as when I last look. I'm going to double check that again, but -110 both ways, basically a pick'em. Maybe we're seeing a little bit of money go to Ponzinibbio since we posted your column yesterday. I'm seeing a couple -120s for Ponzinibbio. It's an interesting situation here, which we'll get to in a bit, but cheap DraftKings prices. Ponzinibbio's 8,200, Neal's 8,000, and the odds to finish are -195. Interestingly enough, Neal is considered more likely to win by KO, TKO. FanDuel Sportsbook has Neal at +195 by knockout. Ponzinibbio is +300 by knockout. So that's something, you know, maybe worth getting into, but this fight is very, very close, and it's going to have a lot of people, you know, torn in both ways. And the backstory I mentioned, I'll get into that before tossing it over to you. Jeff Neal was arrested on Thanksgiving for driving under the influence and a weapons charge. I was reading into that before the show here. His lawyers believe that they're going to get a blood test, and it'll show that his blood alcohol level was under the legal limit of 0.08. And the only reason the weapons charge was there, I guess it was a licensed weapon here. And, you know, this is all per the ESPN report I was just reading, but it's a licensed weapon, but it's only a crime if you're under the influence. So if it shows he what I'm saying is it's not supposed to affect this fight at all. And there's a decent chance with a good lawyer that he can just have the whole thing cleared off. So I think people may be overblowing that a little bit heading into that. But, you know, that's the one big narrative thing that's surrounding this fight here. But Neal lost a couple fights in a row, was at one point considered to be one of the better 170-pound prospects in the UFC, while Ponzinibbio also coming from a long layoff to, you know, maybe mixed results of lately. But I'm going to pass this over to you. You know, what are your thoughts on the breakdown and ultimately who gets their hand raised?
Yeah, you know, I'm actually a little surprised this fight's happening. You know, we're not legal experts, but a lot of times when something like that, this kind of situation happens so close to a fight, it doesn't happen. You know, they pull somebody or whatever, but you know, I agree with you in the sense, I don't think it's really going to have a big impact on the fight. It's getting talked about a bit, but I don't think it's a huge deal. Look, this is it for Jeff Neal. It was it for Jeff Neal before the recent events, but you know, he's got to figure this one out. He's 31 years old. Like you mentioned, lost two fights in a row, Wonderboy Thompson and Neil Magny. Jeff Neal, as you mentioned earlier regarding the knockout odds to finish, Jeff Neal's a heavy-handed boxer. Actually, both of these guys are. Stephen Thompson, even at his advanced age, is probably one of the best kickboxers in the history of mixed martial arts. You know, I picked Thompson over Neal in that fight. I can give him a pass there. But the loss to Neal Magny was ugly. There's no doubt about it. Magny has legitimate power and is adaptable, but Jeff Neal has an edge there and he didn't look good. Jeff Neal has certainly outperformed expectations since he joined the company back in 2018, but he never really has any history of defeating better competition. And it's fair to wonder if he's simply built his name beating up lesser competition. It's not gone easy for Santiago Ponzinibbio either lately. He won 7 straight fights from December 2015 to November 2018. He was legitimately closing in on a title shot at 170 pounds, maybe one or two more wins away, and he would have got there. Then he had a staph infection, which sent him to the sidelines for, God, the better part of 3 years, which is hard to believe. He came back in January, was immediately knocked out by Li Jingliang. And, you know, Li's pretty good. Underrated, actually. I'm a big fan, but we saw
Li. Don't judge what happened to him.
We just saw him get steamrolled by Khamzat.
You know, that'll happen.
Sure. I mean, so that, you know, that is what it is. Guy getting his feet back under him. He fought again this past June. Ponzinibbio did. He took an unanimous decision from Miguel Baeza. Was not a great performance. Still doesn't look like himself. Looks like a guy who's really just still trying to find his footing. Been away for a long time. You know, we're going to get to Dominic Cruz in a couple minutes, but regardless of what he says, Octagon rust is real. And Ponzinibbio is now 35 years old. It's fair to wonder if he simply is just having a bit more difficult time finding his footing and getting back in the rhythm at an advanced age. This is going to be, and I would be shocked if this is anything other than a stand-up fight. You know, in the main event, we spoke about how, you know, Oliveira would prefer to keep it on the mat, while Poirier would prefer to keep it standing. Both these guys want to keep it standing. There's fight-altering power here from both guys. Neither guy averages even a single takedown per 15 minutes, so I don't think anybody has an edge there whatsoever. This is going to be a firefight. The winner is probably going to be the guy whose chin holds up. The advanced numbers from a striking standpoint are eerily similar. There's little separation between the two. Ponzinibbio is an inch taller. Neal has a 2-inch reach edge. This is close, and it's smart. You know, this is smart matchmaking. We just spoke about Nunes and Pena, where they didn't really have much of a choice, but this is smart. You don't want to burn either one of these guys, but Ponzinibbio is getting up there in age. Neal has kind of a mediocre resume. It is what it is. You know, one guy has to win this fight, and I'm going to go with Ponzinibbio. I just ultimately think he's safer, and I made that pick before the recent situation with Neal. I didn't take any of that into consideration. I just think he's safer. I didn't know that knockout prop you said. What is it, plus three something for Ponzinibbio?
Yeah, Ponzinibbio is plus 300, and Neal's only plus 195.
There's no way there should be that much of a gap there.
I think it's because they would expect if Ponzinibbio wins, it's by decision, but they would think Neal, if he wins, it would be more likely to happen by finish.
I would agree with that, but that's a nice number on Ponzinibbio. He's my pick. I think he's a bit safer. I think... with what we've seen lately, that there's a chance Jeff Neal made his name beating up less in competition.
Yeah. See, I actually want to challenge you on that point. And, you know, I marked that down because in 2019, now listen, it's before his 2-fight losing streak, but in 2019, Jeff Neal went out there and decisioned Bilal Muhammad, who is a big time contender in the welterweight division. Then he finished Nico Price and he finished Mike Perry all in one calendar year. And that's what got him a lot of the hype. Now you can discount the Mike Perry win based on what had happened to Mike Perry of late. But I just looked at Mike Perry. Out of his last 6 fights with the company, he was only finished one of those times. He's generally very durable, and that finish came against Jeff Neal. It was in the first round, knocked him down, put him out. I mean, maybe I'm attached a little bit too much to the Jeff Neal of 2019. Because, you know, like I said, he goes out and gets pieced up by Wonderboy, eats 171 significant strikes. Now, before the Wonderboy fight, the other thing, you know, the narrative here we want to talk about with this is so the Wonderboy fight happened in December of 2020. A few months earlier, in August of 2020, Jeff Neal was hospitalized with a mysterious illness that resulted in sepsis and congenital heart failure. He was on dialysis. They thought he was going to die. He made his way out of it. He didn't test positive for COVID. Wasn't really a flu situation here, but he was fighting for his life for a while there. And if you look at the game log, there's a clear before and after here, you know, in his fight log. And after that, he maybe, you could argue, hasn't looked like himself. Now, again, the Wonderboy fight, Wonderboy is, you know, like the best kickboxer, one of the best, if not the best in the division or even in the UFC. And to do that just a couple months after that serious health scare, you could argue if he should have even been in there at that point. But then you give it 5 months and you take the octagon again in May, and he loses to Neil Magny. He doesn't look great. You know, he's not finished in either of these fights. I don't think you're going to – I'd be surprised if Ponzinibbio is able to put him out of there, you know, in any way, and which is why I understand the plus 300 prop. But it's the Magny fight, you're right. That's a little bit concerning. You don't – I know you've never been a huge Magny fan, and I generally – I don't know if it's just the look of him or watching tape on Magny. It always surprises me that he's able to make the most and get wins.
He's crazy adaptable.
Yeah.
Like Neil Magny's not like the most athletic guy in the world, which is why I always bet against him. Cause I think, and it's worked a little lately, but for a while he's just excels at tailoring his game plan to who he fights. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he frustrated Neil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. No doubt about that here. But now I think, you know, Neil's kind of taking a step back, preparing himself for maybe another run. Now, granted, his serious, mysterious illness from August of 2020 doesn't have, we're over a year down the road right now. Hopefully that doesn't, you know, have long-term consequences as for his fight career, because if he loses to Ponzinibbio on Saturday, I'm probably about ready to write him off as a prospect, and I'll just accept him as kind of a fringe ranking guy moving forward. But I actually think, I think I'm going to pick him to win actually against Ponzinibbio, because I'm discounting Ponzinibbio. You're right. Ponzinibbio hasn't exactly looked the same either, you know, over those last couple fights. And I don't know. I think Neil's got more. Maybe the Neil of 2019 that got two knockdowns on Belial Muhammad. Maybe the Neil that was able to put Nico Price and Mike Perry out early in those fights and get a bonus in the Nico Price fight. That's the Neil I'm thinking of in my head. You know, the Thompson and the Magny ones aren't there. And I think if Neil can get back to 80% of that form, I think he blows Ponzinibbio out of the water. There's still, you know, you maybe want to get both sides in this again if you're mass entering here. I like it's not much, but it's $200 off, and on a card where you need to get Nunes in your lineup, probably, you know, Neil at 8,000 gives you a little bit of savings here. I think the betting markets are overreacting to maybe some of that recent news, his arrest, because like you said, I don't really want to, I'm not really buying into that much. Unless there's something going on with that health condition, and only Neil knows this, only his team knows this, unless there's something going on with what happened back in August that's still affecting him, there's not much else I can see, you know, that would really pull me over to the Ponzinibbio side. I made a chart right down the middle here. Both great camps. Neil's a Fortis MMA guy. Ponzinibbio's an ATT guy. You know, Ponzinibbio statistically striking offense and defense a little bit better. I actually, when I put their strength of record up against each other recently, I gave that edge to Neil. So I think that's something we can agree to disagree on. Neil's the younger fighter. Ponzinibbio's a little taller. Neil's got a little better reach. If there's any wrestling, grappling, Neil statistically, you know, has the slight edge there. And, you know, the cherry on top for me was Neil being a better DraftKings play, because if he wins, it seems like it would be higher scoring as opposed to, you know, maybe Ponzinibbio outlasting a decision. So I went Neil on this one. This is going to be split among our staff, because you can make a case very well for either guy. But it depends, like, who is back to the old self that we thought him, because both have taken their lumps lately, and maybe they're both back. Maybe this is a great fight. It's a fight of the night candidate. I mean, some decent volume there on both guys, but I'm not ready to give up on Neil, and the image that I had of him is
they're red flags both ways. Mm-hmm. There definitely are, and I think when this fight is over, we'll probably, because it's really, like you mentioned, it's really kind of the last chance for both guys. Mm-hmm. Between Neil's losses, a couple losses in a row. And, you know, no one's really, if Ponzinibbio loses, who wants a guy who's 1-2 in his last three fights and is 35 years old, you know?
Yeah. I mean, whoever wins gets a big time ranked opponent in their next fight. Whoever loses is gatekeeper, you know?
Yeah. Not much room for error either way.
If it's emphatic win. Okay. So we talked about that one enough. And granted, I wanted to talk about that one a lot, because that's going to be a dividing line with DraftKings. And I was glad that we both had different perspectives on that, so we could give, you know, that's always what I tell listeners, you know, not every single writer is going to agree. And, you know, the 5-6 pieces of content we put up every week, but read through the perspectives. Make your own call on who's got the better point, and hopefully we gave you a good perspective on both guys. But let's talk about some flyweights here. The little guys, Cody Garbrandt, you know, former bantamweight title holder and contender here. He's 8,700 on DraftKings, taking on Kai Kara France at 7,500. The betting odds have Garbrandt about minus 155. Comeback on Kai Kara France plus 135. Odds to finish. This is a little bit odd for a flyweight fight, but minus 165. I guess they see a couple of heavy hitters, and we'll see what happens there. Who you got in this one?
Okay, so, you know, what the big deal is here is this is Cody Garbrandt's flyweight debut. He was supposed to fight Davison Figueiredo, who was champion at the time, a little over a year ago. He was going to fight him for the title. Cody tested positive, was forced to withdraw. Decided to remain at bantamweight for one more bout. Got whipped by Rob Font this past May. Rob Font, who lost to Jose Aldo last week. And now now Cody Garbrandt's dropping down to flyweight. Cody Garbrandt is 1-4. That is not a misprint since winning the UFC bantamweight title from Dominic Cruz in December of 2016. So we're talking, you know, about 5 years ago. He's dealt with a bunch of health issues, a bunch of injuries. I know he had a back issue. I don't have a problem with the decision to move down because of his struggles at bantamweight. I don't think the drop down is going to make that much of a huge difference. I don't think you're going to see Cody Garbrandt just run through flyweights because he decided to drop down a division. Cody has power. He has just never fought smart enough to get to it consistently. His chin is also questionable. The flyweight division might help him, just like you mentioned. You know, guys are less prone to get being knocked out in the smaller weight class. Guys just don't have the same power. But the more I watch Cody Garbrandt fight, the more I think that Cruz fight just was like a perfect storm. I think it was just like his ultimate moment where everything connected, everything went well, and he ended up winning. Look, Kai Kara France, his opponent, has also been inconsistent. He's 2-2 in his last four fights, but he's going to make Cody work here. That much I have no doubt. Kara France lacks secondary skills. He's not much of a grappler, but he's big on volume in the striking game, and he's a good stand-up fighter, which is not a surprise. He trains with Israel Adesanya and Eugene Behrman and the rest of the guys at City Kickboxing, so that's no surprise that he's good on the feet. I'm interested in seeing if Garbrandt uses his wrestling a little more at flyweight. He certainly has a background in it. Never used it much at bantamweight. Averages about one takedown per 15 minutes, just over that 1.05. Cody's 4 inches taller. He should have a big strength advantage. Like if these two guys end up in the clinch or something, Cody should be able to outmuscle Kara France physically. Kara France does have a 4-inch reach edge. That could come into play if it ends up being a kickboxing match. I was very torn here. I went back and forth. I really wanted to fade Garbrandt. It seems like the right idea. It seems like the right move. And I'm not even, and that's before taking into consideration the $1,200 salary difference between the two. I wanted to do it. I ultimately couldn't. I don't like taking guys in new weight classes. Cody's certainly been banged up both health and injury wise. I ended up taking Garbrandt simply because I think this is the kind of opponent Cody can beat at flyweight. Mm-hmm. Kara France is almost as reckless as Garbrandt is. I think Cody can really win if his chin holds up. That's not a guarantee considering what we've seen lately. But I do think this is the kind of fight that favors him. He did last 5 rounds with Font. Rob Font's a really good boxer. Cody did see the final bell in that fight. I'm wagering his chin will hold up long enough that he can get to his offense against Kara France. Not overly confident about it. I would probably actually think Kara France is probably a better DraftKings play considering the salaries. But I think stylistically, this is actually a pretty good matchup for Cody.
Yeah, it's always an interesting chin conversation when you're moving down a weight class, right? Because theoretically, people 10 pounds lighter shouldn't be able to hit you as hard. But at the same time, you're dehydrating your body. You're squeezing every last bit even more, and that might make you more prone to fall asleep should you take a big shot here. And I'm actually very much with you in the sense where, you know, when it comes down to it, I'm going to pick Garbrandt in this fight. I think he'll have enough, a more wide variety of skills. He's faced more killers than Kai Kara-France. But I would agree with you in a sense that Kara-France is probably the better DraftKings play, because 8,700 for Garbrandt makes it real tough to work in Nunes. It makes it real tough to work in Bruno Silva, who's got one of the best knockout props on the card. So it limits you a little bit with your lineup. And Kara-France, you know, with around 5 significant strikes per minute, he could be the higher scorer. I mean, I don't think Garbrandt's going to come out, blitz him, and finish him. I think they'll fill each other out. They'll each have a chance to land. And Kara-France, will score some points and, you know, could maybe take a decision. It's just a 3-round fight. Kara-France loves to pick up the pace. You know, we'll see what happens. The one and final thing I'll say on here, though, is, you know, we mentioned moving down a weight class plenty of times. I would strongly advise getting a look at Garbrandt on the scales on Friday morning. I'm not talking the ceremonial weigh-in that they do with Joe Rogan after everyone's all rehydrated. I'm talking like
talking the 9:30 a.m. one.
Yeah, the early, early ones. You know, you're not really working hard on Friday anyway. Get out your phone. All these sites have streams, you know, MMA Fighting, MMA Junkie, ESPN, all these guys, they have, they have little streams. You can watch these weigh-ins. It's out there for everybody. It's free. Most of them are on YouTube. Take a look at, you know, where he is in the weigh-ins. If he gets out there first, in line, makes weight, and walks off, looks fine, isn't stumbling, doesn't look super emaciated, yeah, then I'll put him in some more lineups here. But if he's one of the last guys out to the scales and he needs his corner holding him up and he's barely on the mark, shaky, then I really rethink using him, you know, at all, or reducing my exposure.
Yeah, so Cody wasn't a small bantamweight either.
Exactly.
Like, you know, he's 5'8". He's not tiny. And yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. And
I'm afraid that, you know, he was 5'8", but still, you know, looked pretty well built at bantamweight.
Yeah.
I'm afraid he'll be a little too slight at flyweight. So I want to get a good look. We'll see what happens here. You know, we'll hopefully get a better indication throughout the week. This is the early look show after all, right? We're kind of giving you guys the context for some of these big fights here, but all right.
And if he looks bad, you'll hear about it.
Oh yeah, yeah, you'll hear about it. Any last notes on him, or should we hit?
No, that's good. I mean, look, I'm going with him, but if Kara-France comes out and pieces him apart, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So yeah, again, no prices, no odds, straight pick him. You take Garbrandt in the pool, but you know, when the price comes into play, I start to lean a little bit more towards Kara-France. But all right, let's take a look. One more fight. I don't think this one needs a really long breakdown. The Sugar Show, Sean O'Malley, he is back, the unranked champion, he calls himself now. Doesn't want to fight the killers until he gets paid that next tier, and we'll see if he can put on a performance to show that he is worthy of that here. He's a -305 betting favorite. Comeback on Paiva +240, 9,100 on DraftKings, and Paiva is 7,100. To me, there's not a lot to break down here. You hit it all in your preview. Taller, longer, O'Malley, crazy high volume. Paiva's striking defense numbers aren't so great. I mean, is this pretty straightforward? Is Sugar Show going to go out there and piece him up?
Yeah, I think he is. And the one thing that surprised me here is, I know Sean O'Malley is kind of pushing for a few more bucks before he gets, you know, a bigger name. I thought he would get a bigger name here, and that's no disrespect to Paiva. I thought this would be a bigger fight for Sean O'Malley. 6-1 in the UFC. 4 knockout wins, 3 performance of the night bonuses. The one loss came against Marlon Vera in a fight O'Malley was dominating before he got injured. He's legitimate. You know, Paiva moved up to bantamweight just this year. He was a flyweight guy, so he essentially did the opposite of what Garbrandt's doing. He took a majority decision from Kyler Phillips. Paiva's 5'8", so he was a big bantamweight, you know. I'm sorry, he was a big flyweight. Same size as Garbrandt. Look, O'Malley's 5'11", which is one of his greatest assets. He's going to be bigger than almost any bantamweight he ever faces. Mm-hmm. He's one of the most creative strikers we've seen. Tons of kicks, all different angles. It's impossible to find somebody to spar with him because nobody can mimic what he does in training. This is straightforward. I think it's going to be a real easy O'Malley win, and I would guess next time that he'll get a rise from the competition, although I thought he'd get one here.
Yeah, I mean, O'Malley is +110 to finish by KO, TKO.
God, that seems low. That seems low, too.
That seems low, too. I mean, the other thing, I mean, people will see Chris Moutinho in his last fight in Vegas go out there, absorb hundreds of significant strikes. That might have even been a record for a three-round fight and not get finished. Maybe some people question O'Malley's power. But either way, even if he doesn't get the finish, 8 significant strikes landed per minute through what's now a decent sample size. Now, granted, that last fight brought it way up, but he has enough potential there to get you a high score in a 15-minute fight, even if he does not get
the See,
fight.
I would say the flip side. I would say it was just the superhuman performance from Moutinho.
Okay.
Yeah. And the thing was almost stopped a couple times, too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. No, it was definitely – I just – all credit to Moutinho, right?
Oh, God, yeah.
But one of the greatest displays of toughness I've seen in my entire life. But heading into this fight, Moutinho had a handful of losses on the regional circuit. He wasn't a big name fighter. He sure as hell came to fight that night necessarily. So I think you could maybe, you know, have a knock on O'Malley for not getting him out of there earlier, although it was close here. But, you know, Moutinho just exceeded expectations. Maybe he's turned a corner, you know, fair enough here. But 110 for O'Malley, I think I'd rather bet that than, you know, take him as a 3-1 favorite. So, you know, that's something to think about, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, if you're confident in him, you could do a little bit of both.
Yeah, fair enough. I think there's some opportunities there. I should mention that on the RotoWire sports betting section here, we've got data from 4 sports books, and maybe we'll get a little arbitrage calculator going here.
I'm just excited. Our next pay-per-view, I'm going to legally be able to do this. Yeah. New York, it's coming to New York. So hope by the Super Bowl, they tell me. So
mm-hmm. No more
I'll be in
Jersey.
I'll know exactly what you're talking about by the time we get to next year.
All right, right on. We can. I'm still waiting in Wisconsin. Might be waiting a little while here, but that's another topic to consider. All right, there are a couple underdogs on this fight. You're definitely going to need a few underdogs in your lineups, especially if you're going for Amanda Nunes. And John, there is one to me that really stood out here. I hope I'm not stealing any of your thunder, but I do want to go.
Now you go. I always go first, so you can go. Who do you got?
The one guy I really like is Augusto Sakai.
You stole it. Go ahead.
Did I steal it? Okay.
That was the one.
I do have a backup in the pocket, but you can hit anyone. I mean, I was surprised to see Tuivasa the betting favorite and the high. I mean, the salaries tend to follow the odds generally. So, right, I guess I was not surprised to see him.
Yeah, the odds are essentially a pick 'em.
Yeah. And the salary, Sakai is $7,900. And, you know, so you save a buck or two there. But listen, Tuivasa, man, I love the guy.
He's terrible.
He is an awesome, cool fan favorite. I love the shooting thing. I can't get enough of it. But let's get real here. I mean, his resume coming into this, so he had lost 3 fights in a row, right? He was on the verge of maybe getting cut. Comes back and knocks out the ghost of Stefan Struve, who goes ahead and retires. Then he knocks out someone named Harry Hunsucker, who I don't believe is maybe he's with you.
There's no way that know. There's no way that fight really happened. Yeah, I don't remember. I wrote that up, and I don't remember that.
Yeah, that doesn't mean anything. And then he goes and he beats Greg Hardy, where, you know, he didn't necessarily look crazy dominated. He caught him with a good check right hook and put Hardy to sleep. And I remember watching that in Vegas, going crazy, celebrating. I loved it, you know. I was almost tempted to stand up on the bar and drink a beer out of my shoe. I was that excited at the time because, hey, you know, Vegas, whatever. However, Augusto Sakai is a different story. Yeah, people are going to look at the recent records and see, okay, ooh, Tuivasa, 3 straight first-round knockouts. Sakai, back-to-back losses. Sakai lost to Rosenstrike and Overeem, 2 top elite heavyweight contenders, and there's no doubt in my mind both of those guys would wreck Tuivasa, if not sooner than they did Sakai. And prior to that, Sakai was on a nice 5-fight win streak with a pretty good win against Blago Ivanov and a pretty good win against Marcin Tybura. And, you know, got a split decision from Arlovsky, who has somehow been winning fights lately once in a
while. I like Ivanov, too. Yeah. He's one of the toughest human beings ever. So if you can get past him, even in a split decision, I'm in.
So the strength of record pales in comparison. These odds don't make any sense to me. This is a Sakai through and through. It's a little risky to take heavyweight underdogs in cash games. It can blow up in your face. And Tuivasa, sure, he has one punch knockout power, but Sakai's the better all-around fighter. And to me, it's not that close. I would have pegged this more along the lines of minus 150, minus 180 Sakai if we were playing against the lines here. So, you know, who knows? Maybe I got a terrible read on this, but Tuivasa, so much fun. Love the guy. I just don't respect the quality of the competition lately, and that's what's fueling the line here.
Yeah, the other thing is, I didn't write this up in full, but Tuivasa was supposed to face Walt Harris in late October. Harris pulled out. Sakai stepped in. They're supposed to fight in November. Visa issues were pushed back here. So essentially, this one came about late. It was supposed to be Harris. But I totally agree with you as far as if you go from a pure – if you're betting on Tai Tuivasa to win, you're always betting on a quick one-punch knockout.
Yeah. Don't even bet the money line. Bet him by finish.
And not only bet him by finish, I would just – if you're going to bet Tuivasa, I would just like first-round prop knockout bet him. Mm-hmm. Just to improve your odds that much if you think he's going to win.
I'm going to see if we got odds for that yet. Some of those prelims fights don't. Tuivasa has the fourth best odds on the whole card of a first round knockout. He's about plus 340, you know, compared to where you're not even getting, you know, plus money on before.
So yeah.
Nunes, Silva, O'Malley, Tuivasa, then Jeff Neal. And there's some on the undercard that haven't came in yet, but, you know, that'll probably play a role in that. But yeah, I mean, that one just doesn't make sense to me. Anyone else jump out as a possible underdog? Anyone you like? Or did I take your guy?
That was the main one. You know, all right, there are two others I'm going to hit quick. And believe it or not, the first one I'm going to go with is Dan Ige against Josh Emmett. And I actually, for the record, I picked Emmett. So I'm going against what I picked. The only reason I mention Ige is Josh Emmett's coming off a bad, bad injury. A bunch of injuries to his left leg. He tore his ACL. He hasn't fought since June 2020.
It's been 539 days since Josh Emmett's last pro fight.
And like Josh Emmett's like good. Like that came, those injuries came in a fight against Shane Burgos, a fight of the night, you know, back and forth. And I like Emmett, but I don't think it's a terrible idea to fade a 36-year-old coming off a major leg injury. Like, I don't think that's the worst plan in the world. So that, you know, that's one.
The reason I had the 539 days queued up is because Danny Ye was my other guy. I don't know if we're on the same page here, if we've just been doing this long.
I took Emmett straight up, but like I have no problem fading a 36. I wouldn't have a ton of confidence.
I mean, Ige's durable as heck at 7,400.
And he's a big volume guy.
He could score decent in a loss.
I have no problem with that.
Quite what I would have expected off the top of my head. I think it's under four significant. Let me check this real quick.
He's a little below four.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, that ain't too bad. That's
solid.
You know, people. He has lost two out of his last three, but they were to the Korean freaking zombie and Calvin Kattar. And he lasted all five rounds, putting up 80 and 84 significant strikes in those fights. So
he's 6 years younger and not coming off a torn ACL.
Yes, exactly. He's been pretty active lately. This is going to be his third fight in 2021 after fighting three times in 2020. So he's fought only six times since Emmett last fought.
Yeah, and there are the two others that, you know, not underdogs. For quite a while now, I'm in full-on fade Eric Anders mode. Like we've figured out that's just not happening. I know he was a Division I college football player at the University of Alabama. But the transition to MMA has been inconsistent, to say the least. That's not to mention the fact that Anders is a late notice replacement. Andre Muniz was originally scheduled to face the entertaining, Dricus du Plessis, the South African, I believe.
Yeah.
Who was very good. So he's in there. And you know, the other one we should probably hit quick is, because I can't ever remember seeing this, Pedro Munhoz and Dominic Cruz, both guys 8,100, both guys minus 110, as close to a pick'em as you can get. Mm-hmm. I don't know. For nostalgic purposes, I pick Cruz mostly because, look, I still like Dominic in kickboxing fights, and that's what Pedro Munhoz does. But that's another one that can go either way. But 81, they're both exceptional fighters. 8,100 is a fair price tag for both. So if anybody has a strong lean on that fight one way or the other, that's a good fight to get in because you're getting a good fighter at a reasonable salary.
Yeah, I'm taking the Munoz side in this one. I like the volume. I know Dominic Cruz beat Casey Kenney, you know, by split decision. He got a couple of takedowns in the striking edge. I don't know. I'm just not confident that Cruz has a whole lot left in the tank at this stage in the game, whereas Munoz has been fighting really, really solid bantamweights to some success here. So I'm on the Munoz side of that, but will he finish Cruz like Cejudo did? Yeah, maybe. I'll have more Munoz than Cruz, but you know, just the price tags in general make it a little bit of an attractive fight from a DFS standpoint.
Yeah, and I mean, there are a couple fighters on the undercard with massive salaries that, you know, I wouldn't touch. Like Jillian Robertson's 9,300. Mm-hmm. Even if she wins easily, she's not the type to rack up a ton of DraftKings points. So
I mean, who is the ref again that let Cashera get beat up so bad by?
Oh God, yeah.
Mario Yamasaki
was right? Yamasaki doesn't ref anymore.
Yeah. No, I know, but the guy let Cashera take just.
Oh yeah, for against Shevchenko. Yeah, that was him.
Yeah, and that's why he doesn't ref anymore. Yeah,
he doesn't ref anymore.
Yeah. Only if he were refing this fight would I take Jillian Robertson at that salary, is what I'm trying to say. The point I'm trying to make there. The heart guy's not sucky.
I mean, you essentially can't take Ryan Hall at 8,900 because he's so awkward and impossible to figure out. Even though I think it's entertaining as hell, you know, the average MMA fan's not going to like a guy rolling around on his back.
He's like a low key entertaining fighter.
He's an acquired taste. You got to really love the sport to like appreciate what, if like you're just with your buddies or you're just hanging out or whatever and you flip it on, like most people are going to be like, what the hell am I watching? You know, that's not for the average person.
Maybe get a little Imanari roll action in there.
Yeah. What am I doing here?
Yeah, you know, yeah, Hall's not knocking anybody out. The way he gets wins in the UFC is snatching onto weird, awkward submissions, tangling you up, getting you in heel hooks, just funny things that, I wouldn't trust him. I wouldn't trust that to happen necessarily, but, you know, Minner is...
not at that price.
Yeah, so, I mean, Hall was a pretty big underdog. I'm going to look at this real quick. I know we got to wrap up. Hall was a pretty big underdog against Topuria in his last fight, and had won... rattled off four fights in a row. Topuria was a step up in top competition. Minner, I don't think, is on Topuria's level, so Hall could maybe get that finish that you're hoping for, but you're hoping for that gone in 60 seconds bonus or just, you know, weird submission, and it's awkward. I don't like to put a lot of stake in that, you know, in this game that we play. At least it'll probably be entertaining from the fans. Any final notes, John?
No, this is a good card. I mean, it's 15 fights deep. There's probably seven or eight like real quality, you know, real quality ones, which, you know, it's solid. It's the whole pay-per-view is good, you know, and you get another, you know, three or four after that, so it's a good card.
All right, right on. Well, that's gonna wrap things up. Thank you everyone out there, whether you joined us live or whether you picked this up on their podcast platforms later on. Thank you very much for listening to the RotoWire Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I got to give you the like and subscribe deal. We're trying to get the RotoWire MMA YouTube channel, those subscriptions up. Really helps us out if you give us a subscribe. Just a couple of videos a month. We're not going to bombard you with stuff. So thank you for doing that. Once again, give John a follow on Twitter at JONLITTERINE. You can follow me at RotoJake. Man, we got a long break ahead. I'll see you in 2022, John.
Yeah, January 22nd. I might have my legal betting by then. Nice.
Yeah, that'll be fun. We'll definitely have to dive into that as well. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and take care. Good luck with your lineups.
Happy New Year. Happy holidays.